When you get into the things of God, one of the little personal mantras I have is there's always things more to know. There's always more things to know. And the other is not to come to the conclusion that you are now a senior saint, so you already know everything. We're going to talk about this today. Stay with us. It's August the 18th, Monday, and welcome to All Things Apostolic. We're glad you're with us again today, and we hope you had a great weekend with the blessings of God just flowing immensely. I know that last weekend was a tremendous, tremendous Sunday with Brother Isaac Hernandez, and then yesterday is another great time to just good things happening. I just completed a leadership meeting, which is called, I love the name, Connor's Boot Camp. And that's with Pastor Paul Connor and the church Faith Tabernacle in Tucson, Arizona. Many people there from throughout the state. It was a great, I mean, for these meetings, you know, where it's a leadership meeting primarily maybe for pastors and preachers and maybe other select leaders. A meeting like that, maybe 30, 40 people, and sometimes less, sometimes more. But there was probably, I mean, I'm just guessing, I didn't count, but probably 250 people there. And it was a great time of advancement. And I think people left there with all of us having a new awareness of the potentiality, not only of Faith Tabernacle, but of other churches and ministries throughout Arizona. So that was great. And they are such consummate hosts, and the church is a solid, impressive, wonderful place. If you live in the Tucson area, you need to go there. Faith Tabernacle is the name of the church. Pastor Paul Connor and his family are great leaders also that are in the process of developing. I love it when people recognize that they haven't attained everything and that we all have a whole lot to learn. I like that kind of people because they're always hungry to know more, to be better, to do better. And so this is great. And then came home Tuesday night. We had a celebration service. It's probably online if you want to see it. A celebration service of our pastor and his wife and our youth pastor, which is their son, Boston, all receiving their doctoral degrees at the same time. And so the church wanted to celebrate that. Two reasons. One is it's a great accomplishment and an enormous challenge, especially when you're doing that and you have more than full-time work on your plate every day. With the church and ministry in concentric circles that go out, you know, citywide and then statewide and nationwide and international, and all of those are pieces that all three of them are dealing with on a regular basis. But it was a great time. I looked up some statistics. Where there is a father and son that receives a doctor's degree in the same family at the same time from the same institution was, I may have told you this before, but it's fine. Hang in there. Is 0.001% of the people in America that occurs in 1/1000th. So you take 1% and then you chop it into 1,000 little pieces and you take one little 1,000 pieces. That's a percentage that happens in. So that's just a you know, you say, well, what are you saying? I'm just saying it's just an unusual positive thing. So then I looked up the percentage of people where there is a husband and wife that both receive their doctorates from two different institutions. One's a D doctor of ministry. The other is a PhD. And I don't know what exact name, processes and leadership in business and whatever. And one's from Howard University, one's from Corbin University. And then Boston's is also from Corbin University. So to have a husband and a wife and a son all at the same time, they said the coordination required to do that would take years, which is all true. Well, here's the little hidden secret. They didn't coordinate all this. It just happened. And so there are no statistics for how rare that is. They said, in fact, it's so rare that that there are no records of anybody having ever done that. So we had a great time celebrating and people expressing appreciation for leadership. And I was able to say, why, what difference does it make? Do we believe that having that is the great divider between people? And it's certainly not. It is, it's like mountain climbers. They say, well, why did you climb that mountain? Well, I just noticed that it was there and thought, you know, I had to do what I can, and so they climbed the mountain. So here's what I found out, though, through the years. All of these things that we do without having to first base it in a utilitarian reason, instead of starting with practical application that always has to do with down here, start with how can I make myself improved, that is, at least in the general way, in my world. Like, these weren't just any doctorates, they were within the context of improving them in their world. And so people are just doing that. They're just doing that. That's part of the outgrowth of the experiment with our slogan for the Rock Church, which is helping people become. So somebody says, well, the first thing a church ought to be doing is getting people saved. Right, right. That's the first way we help people become. Because what is saved? How did Jesus describe saved? He described it as birth. You must be born again. So is birth the end of a human journey of life, or is it the beginning? And so in helping people become, the beginning of becoming is being born, obviously. You can't become if you don't be. You got to be first to become. And so to be in the theological context of man's fallen condition, you have to be born again. So that's the start. That's where we start. And then we start training people there, and then they start growing, and here we go. From there, they continue the journey to become. So we should never end the journey to become. For example, right now, in waiting for the appointment time in which we were doing this particular podcast, I was working on an eschatology class. So the school now, we have got to the place who we are capable of offering a master's degree. It will go for substantive change with the accrediting association. By the way, I had somebody ask me this week, says, does the accrediting association or the state, when you get accredited, do they start monitoring what you teach? And I've heard that before. There's people that think that is not even remotely true. Frankly, they don't care what you teach. They care about the quality of the product, of how it's taught. Does it have sufficient rigor that student is getting an education commensurate with what they're paying? And so that's why they check how many pages of reading is required for this course, how many hours of lectures are included in this course, what kind of assessment instruments have you created, tests, quizzes, written papers, so forth, speeches, all of this, and more. All of that is what the Accrediting Association looks at. So accreditation is not about the subject matter. They don't even ask one single, I've never been asked one single question about that in years of teaching or as president or chancellor of Wilson University. So that's not what it's about. They're about the quality that, they're about protecting students and making sure that what they get, whatever it is quality in the presentation and in the content. So anyway, so we are planning on launching our grad degree, master's degree, this coming year, 2026. In doing that, there are some classes that we have in mind to do, but they have to be created. So you've got what we call course development. And all of this is a tremendous, cost a lot of money. And we thank the Kish Foundation for helping us with course development funds and the liaison and a director of a portion of those funds has been gracious in helping us to do this. And so anyway, we're in that process. Well, in developing these courses, you have what they call subject matter experts, SMEs, S-M-E, subject matter experts, that create these courses. These people, of course, are scholars that in the particular subjects that they are developing, they have to have education in those courses. If you have someone that's got something to offer that's not educated properly, but they do have the information, then you can make them like guest lecturers. So there's a way to include everybody's expertise without getting hung up in the weeds of organizational structures, educational organizational structures. And so anyway, we are in this process of developing this. And it there's it's going to be an incredible graduate degree for apostolics because it's written by apostolics. Then it's sent to experts among experts that may or may not be apostolic to make sure that the rigor and the presentations are on the highest world-class quality. No exaggeration. And all of this is being done. And there's courses like Pentecostal spirituality. Pentecost has its version of spirituality. It has its definition of spirituality and has many implications. What about the spirit world? What about, how is the spirit world constructed? And what are the things that we need to know about principalities and powers? And how does the government of heaven work? It'll shock a lot of people how the government of heaven works when you get into the word, begin to look at these things. And then you have to have books that are finely attuned to the subject matter, which reveal portions of stuff. And you have to have lecturers that know what they're talking about, people that have experienced, in this case on spirituality, people who have experienced spiritual things, supernatural events, facing spiritual powers that are malevolent, that are hostile to the human race and to humans and to the kingdom of God and to anything that has to do with the well-being of the human race, which is intended to rule the earth. God told them to take dominion. So what are those opposition forces like? And are there levels of those forces? Okay, so that's in the spiritual. There's another one about advanced apostolic theology, the Godhead and holiness and salvation and stuff that goes beyond just being able to memorize and quote the very important elements of Acts chapter 2. And what about how do these things fit? So it's stuff that normally people don't get to that is extremely important and exciting for apostolic people. And then there's, of course, on eschatology. That's broadsided us, because when you get into eschatology, there's plenty of books. So, I mean, you can just take these books and use them, because even if they're books that are off in some areas, you can identify that. But in other areas, they have tremendous scriptural insights with which we would all agree. And so when we got to eschatology, we found out we knew this, but we just never, I don't know. Anyway, we found out that there are no real scholarly apostolic Pentecostal books. I mean, on eschatology. Now, there's some really good apostolic books on the book of Revelation and on the book of Daniel that are scholarly, that have went deep into things and presented. And where there's things that have ambiguity, they show you the alternatives. And so there are those. But when you take not just Daniel and Revelation, but you take the whole subject of eschatology and you look at the whole, then we have little, if any, books. So in writing the course, we end up, not just myself, but we end up having to write like a whole book on an apostolic Pentecostal version of eschatology. So anyway, we've been working on that. So my intention today was to get to a place where I could talk about how theology down through the ages and the theology that came out of the Reformation, how that agrees with Pentecostals and how that doesn't agree with Pentecostals. So all of this introduction has taken up my time. So maybe next week we'll hit it. Thank you for being with us today.